out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's date is April the 20th, 2018. Yes, that's right, it's Adolf Hitler's birthday, and we've got a special podcast for you today talking all about Adolf Hitler, and I'm very pleased to welcome to the Daily Nationalist for the first time Chris Cantwell from The Radical Agenda. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Sven. Good to be with you, man. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I've wanted to get you on since you came to Radio Arian a couple of weeks back, and unfortunately we haven't had a chance to until now. But I think today it's going to be a good discussion and a really good topic to go into. What is it that really strikes you about Adolf Hitler? I know that you're selling Mein Kampf on your website. I know that you think a lot of the man. So just what is it about Adolf Hitler that really struck you as being so different from everyone else?
Well, you know, that's let me sort of tell you how I came to the opinion first, and then I'll try to work on the question that you actually asked me. I think, like most people in America, I'm raised with the idea that Hitler and evil are synonyms, right? And even as I started getting into the sort of subject matter that we discuss on the Radical Agenda today, I'd sort of come over from the libertarian space, and like a lot of right-leaning people in America, I think of, you know, I associate Hitler with National Socialism, and over here, socialism is a dirty word on the right. And so even as I started getting into racial subject matter, and even as I started talking about the JQ, I wasn't terribly well informed about Adolf Hitler. And so where some people would do like, you know, the 1488 thing, some Radical Agenda listeners started doing like 1433. Because I said, OK, I'm cool with the 14 words, but I'm not sure about this Hitler guy or whatever. And Christopher Cantwell, CC, third letter of the alphabet. Some of my listeners made this meme up or whatever. And I only read I had watched The Greatest Story Never Told. And that was enlightening, certainly. But then I read, when I was in jail in Charlottesville, I read Hitler's Revolution by Richard Teeter. And of course, I read Mein Kampf. And I got to tell you, the ideas that were contained in those books were very appealing. But I also, I think one of the things that stands out to me the most is just Hitler had a way with words, right? And I saw a lot of he had a thing for the spoken word, especially. And he was kind of what am I looking for here? He said, oh, we have to commit this to writing because that's sort of how these things go. But the spoken word is like the most important thing. And I noticed that in my own life. I had made a name for myself as a writer. But when I wanted to start doing this professionally, I just responded to market demand and I became a podcaster. And so this is not the most hard hitting of points. I'm enjoying the man's literary style is I guess what I'm trying to communicate.
Yeah, it's great. I understand what you mean there. I mean, his oratory was absolutely electric, and the writing in Mein Kampf, although translating it into English, obviously you're going to lose a little bit there. I just found it to be really, really inspirational. And everything that he was saying in there was based upon the truth. It's not the sort of thing that I was expecting to read in Mein Kampf. I came to it from the conspiracy side of things. And again, watching The Greatest Story Never Told, that was, you know, that really opened my eyes up to the fact that we've been lied to all this time. And then you read Mein Kampf and you learn about the way that a state should function and how the state is there to look after the people that make up the state. And then you look at the terrible situation that we are in now with traitors in power, and they're working against our best wishes. And you think this small country, Germany, with this man, Adolf Hitler, he had the tenacity to take on the whole world. You know, the whole world fought against this small country, and they managed to keep the walls at bay for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And he was in power for 11 years, I believe. And just in the short amount of time that he had, he managed to get everybody back to work. He built the infrastructure, built the roads, got everybody to have a car, started giving houses. And it was just like a revolution that the world has never known before, and a peaceful revolution at that.
Yeah, and the other thing about it was, as you sort of alluded to in there, you know, I had never heard anybody make the case for the state the way he did, right? And I came over here from the libertarian space, and there was sort of, if you will, a lot of deconstructionism going on in there, and talking about the state as some strange and unnatural aberration that, you know, was talking about as a dumb superstition and stuff. And I had really bought into a lot of that for a long time, because you didn't really see, I hadn't heard somebody really make a more convincing case for it, right? The left over here, they just think that the state is, you know, it's just a redistribution mechanism just to take money away from people. And I always thought of that as disgusting and dysgenic and whatnot. And then and conservatives, they'll just sort of make this matter of fact, ever so thusly, you know, this is the role of government, and I just baselessly assert it type of argument, right? And reading Mein Kampf, you know, Hitler viewed it as you're aware, of course, as it's a completely organic institution. Yes, this is natural to us, and it has a purpose, and here's what it is. And it's the purpose of the state is the maintenance of the race. And in that sense, like when a state loses track of that, well, then you can see why people start losing faith in it, right? There's nothing to do with it just abandons its eugenics programs, it abandons its borders, it's just a series of economic policies or something like that. And then shockingly enough, people see no purpose in it and see no benefit in it, and then the society starts falling apart. I had never seen anybody make the case for the state, I guess, as a eugenics program prior. And once I read that, my entire worldview changed.
Yeah, I think you came to it from a similar area that I did. I was into the sovereign citizen side of things and the free man on the land and all of that. And then discovering national socialism, it all of that just seemed to sort of not be completely insignificant, but of so much lesser importance, the way that laws were written. What was far more important was that we had people running things that were doing things for our best interests. You say, not just for economics, not just looking at people as economic units, how much money can they make? It was looking at the people as their whatever is to their good is the highest good. That is the greatest good. And everything within the state, everything within the country must be working to that template of doing what's best for the people. So you wouldn't have usurious business practices. You wouldn't have usury banks. You wouldn't have pornography. You wouldn't have degeneracy. I mean, at the time, there were German women that were being turned into prostitutes. They're women and daughter prostitutes. There were pregnant prostitutes. Total degeneracy was going on, where the Jews had screwed the country so much after the Versailles Treaty and completely crashed the economy. And the miracle of Adolf Hitler, once he took power, was changing all that around and managing to do that within 3 years, which gives us an inspiration of how we could do it. Now, one of the things that must have been quite difficult for you, I would guess, is the fact that the right-wing state, the National Socialist state, people say, oh, that's fascist. And the meaning behind that is fascism is controlling of people, controlling of all their lives. And libertarianism is, you know, you take responsibility for yourself, and there aren't so many laws. So how did you bridge the gap between the two, I guess, is what I'm saying?
Yeah, I sort of view this as, I think that if you have a homogenous white society, then it can be very libertarian. When you have this racial adulteration that happens through lax immigration policy and whatnot, then like things require intelligent correction. And so that's sort of how I view it. Some people have described it as sort of passing through the eye of fascism to reach a more libertarian society, because as you mentioned, you know, if you have Jews just subverting everything, you know, shockingly enough, this has bad consequences. If you have blacks coming in and taking up space in the intestines like a tapeworm and draining resources off the society, you know, this has deleterious impacts. And so these things need to be corrected, and they require a degree of force to do. But if they hadn't happened, I mean, you know, do you need to have strict speech laws if you don't have Jews deconstructing everything and subverting your society? I don't think that you really do. But once you have Jews doing that, you need to fix it. And so, you know, it doesn't come immediately naturally to me to endorse a great deal of authoritarianism. What really made me take an interest in politics was my dissatisfactions with the state. And so I thought of restraining its power in every possible sense was sort of the way to address my concerns. But what I'm realizing is that, you know, those powers are becoming necessary as a result of more natural authority not being asserted prior.
And if the authority is being asserted for the good of the people rather than for the good of bankers and for the good of foreign interests, then that is rightful authority, and that's the way that things should be. You know, I used to hang around with anarchists, and they used to be saying, you know, we don't want people interfering. And you just think, well, if you didn't actually have somebody to defend you, then it's just going to be whoever's got the most weapons is just going to take over. And that is not going to be somebody who should rightfully be in power. Who should rightfully be in power is the person with the most merit, the person who is most dedicated to looking out for the interests of his nation. And Adolf Hitler was completely selfless in that respect. I mean, he was completely self-sacrificing. He didn't get married until right at the very end. I mean, he was married to his nation. Everything that he did was for the good of the nation, and he arose from nothing. This is one of the things that really appealed to me about him was the fact that he had been homeless for a certain amount of time. He had lived on the streets. He had been in prison for a certain amount of time. He had worked his way up from being right down there in the working class to leading the nation. So he had seen things at both ends of the scale. One of the big problems that we have today is that politicians they're brought up to be politicians. They're born into these families. They have lots of money. They don't see how things are like for the working class. They don't see how things are like for people on the streets. And Adolf Hitler grew up from that. He was raised up from that, and he fought with distinction. In the First World War, he was given all these awards for bravery. The job that he had was one of the most dangerous jobs there was, and yet one of the most important ones. It was running to the front with the mail, and we know how important messages from your loved ones are when you're fighting in war or when you are in prisons. And the guy really deserved to be in that position that he was in. I it was totally by merit and not by anything else. And we haven't seen anything else like that since, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't believe that we have. And so it was a remarkable story, just his sort of scraping through the ranks, if you will, to the position that he ultimately ended up obtaining. And it was inspirational in that sense. And you don't see that anymore. I mean, the closest thing we have, I think the only veteran that we had running in recent presidential elections was John McCain, who is not exactly not exactly who I want to have as my president. And so It is a remarkably different story than we're used to seeing now. These guys are so detached. I mean, we just had this you know, tax cut thing that was passed over here, and it's the results in, you know, I forget exactly what the numbers are, but, you know, the average family's going to get a couple $1,000s extra a year. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi gets up there and says, that's crumbs. And it's like, yeah, it's crumbs to you, Nancy Pelosi, right? You have no concept of what it's like to care about $2,000 a year.
And then also, when you think about the actual caliber of Adolf Hitler and the men of his time, you just brought up John McCain then and his record. And it's, you know, it's nothing compared to the sort of people that we had during the war. When you hear about some of the people that fought on the Axis side, some of these heroes, they really were heroes, the sharpshooting heroes, the people that were flying in the Messerschmitts. I mean, you know, on both sides, when you think back to that time when aeroplanes used to just be held together with string and made out of lightweight wood, and you've got these pilots there that are having these dogfights in the sky, and these were incredible men, and the war itself destroyed that. It destroyed so many of the best men that Europe has ever produced in this absolutely senseless brothers war. That was all it benefited is the Jews. I mean, that war was lost by the white man and won by the Jews. I you know, it makes me ashamed to think that my British ancestors went along with the lies that they were told. Winston Churchill, one of the most evil men that ever lived, and he's held up to be a hero now. It's the same with Roosevelt, and to think that they had an alliance with communism as well, an alliance with Stalin to fight against Germany, you know, the cultural center of Europe. It's
yeah,
terrible.
Especially reading Richard Teeter's Hitler's Revolution in Jail really hammered that home. And it sort of struck me some time back, right? I like to listen to conservative talk radio in the car. I have the satellite radio. I get the Patriot Channel. And, you know, these guys they hate Roosevelt, right? They think Roosevelt, FDR, was like the worst president ever. But, you know, that one major foreign policy decision, that totally makes up for it, right? FDR is a hero as long as he's fighting the Nazis, except everything he did at home was absolutely terrible, right? Well, it's funny to me how they have so much trouble analyzing that, right? Like, oh, we teamed up with the communists to give Germany to the Soviet Union, and that's a really good foreign policy idea by the guy who basically tried to institute a bunch of communist economic policy here in the United States. It's amazing that people are unable to see past that.
Well, at the same time, you had in America, you had the Great Depression, didn't you? This was the thing that I think they tried to keep what was actually happening in Germany from the people in America. They certainly tried to keep it from the people in Britain. They banned the you know, the boats that they had pleasure cruisers. If you worked in Germany, then you were entitled to a free holiday on a pleasure cruiser. And this was unheard of anywhere else. And they actually banned these cruisers from docking in Britain because they didn't want the workers in Britain knowing about the much better conditions that they had over in Germany. I mean, in Britain at the time, you had people walking all the way from Wales to London to try and get work. You know, there was a Great Depression in America. There was a depression in Britain. Germany had all these problems with the Weimar Republic. And yet suddenly within 3 years, the workers in Germany had all had their conditions improved. They had a Clean Air Act. They had recreation time. They had these holidays paid for. Mothers had special training in how to be mothers. They were not encouraged to work. They were encouraged to give birth. Each child that they gave birth to, they received 25% off a new home. And with the building of the new homes, there was an increase in job production. I mean, one of the things that impressed me when Donald Trump first took power, he was talking about improving all this infrastructure and getting America to go back to work. And it did remind me of what Adolf Hitler was saying, but we haven't really seen this from Donald Trump. I mean, it's quite bizarre that the mainstream media has been likening Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler. And Donald Trump is nothing like him, but it just shows you how much we have degenerated since the 30s and the 40s that we think somebody like Donald Trump is like Hitler. You know, it's the same with the character of the people now. It's nothing like it was back then in the 30s and the 40s. We live in a completely different era now. And this is what I say when people say, oh, we should ignore the people that just criticize the Muslims. Well, we live in a completely different era. People back then in the 30s and 40s, most people were aware of the Jewish question, and it was quite easy to find out about the Jewish question. And there wasn't these anti-Semitic speech laws that we have now. Whereas nowadays, people don't see that. People see Muslims. They see the Muslim rape gangs. They see the Muslim problem, and they don't really see the Jewish problem. So today we have moved on. We cannot just repeat everything that Adolf Hitler did. You know, we can't dress up like stormtroopers or wave swastikas. That's not going to get us anywhere. And in the same place, you know, if you're standing up and you're in public and you're speaking out against the Jews, but most people aren't going to be able to follow what you're talking about. If you are talking about Islam, though, you're talking about Muslims, people can see that. They can see that problem. And one of the things that used to get me, I used to think about America. I used to be quite anti-American. And then when I discovered all of this, I realized it wasn't anti-American. It was anti-Jew. It was the Jews on the American TV that really irritated me. It was the Jews in the Hollywood media that really got to me, that were putting all these degenerate ideas into the films. Again, this is another thing that Adolf Hitler changed. He changed the film industry. I mean, the German film industry used to promote really, really wholesome films. They would never show any German soldier that would get killed on screen or anything like that. And they exposed the Jews, they exposed the bankers, they exposed the Rothschilds, they exposed the Freemasons in film. They were educating their people to what was going on in the world around them, and they were uplifting them and providing them the means to improve themselves. This was also another big part of National Socialism, was improve yourself. Not hold your hand out and get given a handout, but we will hold out our hand and help you to pull you up out of the dirt where you are and help you to become the best person that you possibly can. And that's right at the heart of National Socialism, is self-improvement. And that's something that people can still do to this day, is take the ideas from National Socialism and transpose them into the 21st century. And this was another side of it. It was what Adolf Hitler was enumerating in Mein Kampf were our eternal principles, things that are going to be the same no matter what era that we live in. You just have to change them slightly, but the actual essential principle remains the same. Those 25 principles of National Socialism, they can still be applied to this day, and we still need to be doing the things that Adolf Hitler did. We need to be cleaning up our movie industry. We need to be cleaning up the country. We need to be getting rid of foreigners, or at the very least, making them non-citizens. They should not have the same rights as we do. You know, I mean, that's just basic. How do you feel about the rights for these people? Because, I mean, coming from the libertarian background, it's all about everybody having the same rights. How do you feel about that and the equality side of things, Chris?
Well, you know, the idea ought to be that, the people within, people need to be treated equally under the law, but they also need to be ostensibly equal in order for that to be reality, right? So, like, I don't think that I should be sharing a system of government with ethnic groups that have interests that are diametrically opposed to mine. And so that's why I have become an advocate of secession in order to obtain an ethno-state, right? You can't have a society that treats blacks and whites the same, because they're not, right? And so they need to live in separate societies has been how I sort of reconcile that. And again, this requires a degree of intelligent correction after this adulteration has been allowed to ensue for generations, right? And that is going to more than likely result in a lot of unhappy people, at least for some temporary period of time, but it will result in a whole lot less misery and violence, you know, long term, as long as the correction is intelligently made. You know, to the thing of people comparing Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler, I would say that while we can draw an infinite number of distinctions between Donald Trump and Adolf Hitler, I think the reason that people sort of make that comparison more than anything is because he would dance right on the edge of race realism. Okay. And that way of thinking. They just thought that that was so dangerous, and they were absolutely correct in that if people started looking at things in that way, it's only a matter of time before you get to the Jews, right? If you say, you know, Muslims are an incompatible culture, and the Mexicans flooding into the country are having a bad impact on us, and you start thinking in those terms, it's only a matter of time before you notice that Jews aren't white people. And I think that that's what they were all terrified of, because even as I started to get concerned about immigration, and it was really immigration into Europe that concerned me even before in the United States, I just saw this flood of Muslims coming into Europe, and I realized, like, that's really dangerous. And people started calling into the radical agenda like it's the Jews. And I didn't understand that at all, right? I was like, how do Jews benefit from Islamization of Europe, right? It didn't seem to me like that would be a good idea for them. Last I checked, Muslims were not big fans of Jews. But once you start looking at things in those terms, you realize, oh, wait a second. All right, that's the benefit that they get from this. They're advocating for this because they just want to, they do not want there to be a white majority that can act against their ethnic interests or whatever. And I think that once people started seeing that Trump was bringing that side of the conversation into our mainstream politics, that scared the hell out of a lot of people, and frankly, for good reason.
It's a similar reasoning why they go after the civic nationalist groups, saying here in Britain, at the moment, we've got the leaders of Britain First are in prison. And they certainly don't expose the Jews, and they say they're not racist. And yet still, they've been put in prison, and the government has said that they want to have them listed as terrorists. And the reasoning behind that is because they know that they're a gateway. They're a gateway to harder things. They're a gateway to us. They're a gateway to ethno-nationalism. And that's why the Jews go after these groups. You know, I don't like to criticize them too much. I certainly wouldn't want to get rid of them at all, because I see them as a stepping stone to better ideas. The same as, you know, your podcast, when you're into the libertarian side of things, you know, that helped to bring you to ethno-nationalism with your listeners that were listening, and they came along with you. You know, it's we cannot just, I think it's very hard for people to just jump straight in at the deep end. You know,
yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, and I've tried hard, you know, not to be constantly attacking people or just slightly to my left or whatever, you know, and that can be difficult because, sadly, at least over here, they're constantly attacking us. They're always punching right, trying to distinguish themselves from those evil races. Right. But those guys are doing good work. And the thing is that when people start stumbling down those paths, they're like, okay, let's be a little bit further right today than we were yesterday. You know, once they're at a certain level of it, it's only a matter of time before they start seeing the contradictions, right? It's like, why do we care about immigration? Well, we care about immigration because there's a genetic component to this. This is not just about how people pray or what language they speak. This is actually, you know, this is a very serious matter, and it's impossible for people. Well, maybe not everybody, but it's impossible for some number of people not to figure that out as they sort of venture down that spectrum. That's why, like, even like the gender stuff. I mean, you know, how hostile people are to like something as milquetoast as a voice for men. You know, because once you start thinking of things in terms of biology, you're like, yes, men and women are different, and here are some of the biological differences between them. It's not long before you get into, well, there are biological differences between racial groups as well. And you start thinking of things in those terms. Well, you know, then you're going to, it's a as you say, a gateway. You know, it's you're opening up a door that leads to the conversations that we're having today, and they don't want that to happen.
It's the ultimate danger to them. Again, this is, you know, another difference between the time of Adolf Hitler to now. I mean, he spoke out about how you couldn't have any other political parties but the National Socialist Party, because you just wanted people to hear the truth. But we have more than just political parties today. We have the internet. And if people are going to be looking up this civic nationalist stuff online, they're going to be looking up information on Muslims, information on immigration. They're going to be going to the civic nationalist sites. And then from there, when they put in the search terms, they're going to find ours as well. You know, they're going to find our information, and they're eventually going to come to the truth. I mean, it's a gradual process for people. It's never just straight in at the deep end. It's always it always follows a line, either from the conspiracy side of things to finding out about the Holo hoax to investigating National Socialism, or looking at the libertarian side of things and being willing to question taboo subjects. And that's another thing. I mean, it's a very taboo subject, race, and you have to be fairly brave to investigate it. And then once you have to have a certain amount of courage to admit that your understanding of things was wrong before then. A lot of people have a lot of investment in their liberal views, and to turn around from that to becoming a nationalist, it takes a certain amount of courage. And I think you've shown that you've got that courage, Chris, definitely, in coming to these views from the libertarian background. You know, I think you have integrity, and I think you've shown that you've got courage by doing that.
Thank you very much, man. Yeah, it was it has been a rough ride. I mean, somebody just brought up on the Radical Agenda today, just a few days ago, that, well, at this point, just over a year, I guess, has passed since Richard Spencer's speaking engagement at Auburn University in Alabama. And like that floored me, because that was like the first time I had stepped out into the real world with the alt-right or whatever. And I was like, it's been less than a year. I can't believe this. And things have just changed so, you know, dramatically. I used to be on, you know, broadcast radio. I was on 150 broadcast stations across the United States. And, you know, somebody brought up race and IQ on the internet. And for agreeing with the science, they asked me to apologize. And I was like, well, if I'm wrong, then tell me what I said wrong, and I'll amend my opinions. It seems to me like there's some science here, and I'm not going to apologize just because it made people upset. And literally, one of the co-hosts of the show, is a now famous clip that I play on the Radical Agenda from time to time. He says that true statement is racist, you know. And it's like, well, you know, I got into this as, you know, a guy who is interested in the truth. That if truth and racism are the same thing, then I guess I'm going to be a racist. And so it has certainly been a wild ride, and there's been a lot of bumps in it. But I think it's been worth it, and I think that it's only going to get better from here.
Definitely, definitely. Chris, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. You can check out The Radical Agenda later on today on radioarian.com. I'll be back after the weekend. God bless and hail victory.